Good morning, everyone. So last week we read through Canto 2 of Book 1, Canto 2, the issue. And then we had only time to read the first 24 lines at the beginning of the canto, which continues on from Canto 1. It describes Savitri waking up in the morning, gathering force. And here at the beginning of Canto 2 is the wonderful description of her remembering, looking back over her life and remembering everything that has led up to this moment when she wakes up on the day when Satyavan must die. So we read those 24 lines, and we'll move on from there. Bom, would you read?
Absolutely supernatural, darkness of force, of man sometimes when he draws near to God. On our arrival, when fair all nature's need, forced out from the protecting ignorance, and flung back on his naked primal need. He at length must cast from him his surface soul and his ungarbed entity within. That hour had fallen now on Savitri, a point she had reached where life must be in vain, or in her unborn element away. For we must cancel her body's destiny. For only the unborn spirit's kindness power can lift the yoke imposed by force in time. Only the self that feels is the future of self can raise the fixed interminable line that joins these changing names into numberless lives. His new oblivious personalities and keep still locked in our conscious acts, the trail of old forgotten thoughts and deeds, disown the legacy of our buried self, the burdensome fellowship to our vanished forms, accepted blindly by the body and soul.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, Bom is asking about these last two lines on page 11, that a time comes to a human being, it may come, comes sometimes, when all nature's means, if all the possibilities we have, the human possibilities we have, fail. There's nothing. No? And then we are forced out from this protecting ignorance, which hides a lot of the truths of the universe from us. We are, he says, flung back on our naked primal need. I think this is the need to survive as an individual. So in order to do that, the individual has to abandon this surface soul. It's a projection of the true soul within, which is here to help us deal with all the eventualities of life. But when that moment of absolute supernatural darkness comes, then the being is forced to throw away all the surface. Nature is in any case no use. Even the surface soul doesn't help. Has to identify with the true, eternal, infinite self within, the ungarbed entity within. Usually that entity, which is our true, eternal, and infinite individuality, is hidden from us by many layers of coverings. But all those have to be thrown away so that the entity is ungarbed, naked and uncovered. So that is the hour that has fallen now on Savitri. She has nothing to turn to except her own innermost self and the strength of that self. She's come to a point where her life, the meaning of her life is being challenged. No? Her life must be in vain, or it will be in vain unless her will can wake up in her unborn entity, in the part of her which has never begun and will never end. No? It is born again and again and again, but it is the unborn element in her. Her will must wake up there and cancel the destiny of this particular embodiment of this body. And then Sri Aurobindo explains that it's only the timeless power, the strength which is transcendent of the spirit, the unborn spirit, can change the conditions of earth, can lift the yoke imposed by birth in time. When the eternal soul takes birth in the evolutionary this evolutionary creation, it accepts the conditions, the material conditions of time and space and karma, all that is the human race has inherited from its past development. That's the yoke. It's something that helps us to carry a heavy burden. It's also something that links us. It's the what links us to the rest of life in the manifestation. So that unborn, that ungarbed entity, the self with a capital S, the true self, that builds this figure of self that we are wearing in this particular incarnation. That's the only power, the transcendent power, can raise, can scratch out that line, that endless line that's joining all these many incarnations that we have taken, all these changing names, these numberless lives, these new oblivious personalities. Each of them has forgotten all the others. No? And that line normally keeps still, hidden, hiding in our conscious acts, the trail of old forgotten thoughts and deeds from previous lives. No? Only that highest self, which is really beyond free of the manifestation, can disown everything that we've inherited, our legacy of all those buried selves, buried long ago. It can disown this burdensome, heavy airship. We are inheriting the thoughts and deeds and this trail connecting all those past lives. It's a heavy thing to inherit when we come into the world. No? And that burdensome airship is normally accepted blindly by the body and the soul. No? So the only part in us that can change that destiny, the destiny of the body, the destiny of the current formation, the current personality, is our transcendent self. So that is what now Savitri is challenged to do. She has to access the spirit's timeless power to lift the yoke, the fate that's been imposed on her in this birth in time. Yes,
I have multiple questions.
Okay, start with number one. Start with number one.
Number one is there are five senses and there are five elements.
Mm.
Is there any connection between these two? And number two?
No, let's deal with the questions one by one. And the unborn element, I don't think it is any of the five elements. These five elements are the elements out of which the material universe is created. The finest and rarest of them is the ether. But I think this unborn element is beyond even the ether.
That's the answer I was looking for. So Mother was talking about, it's not only five senses, we actually have 12 senses.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, there are not only five elements, there should be more elements. So there is a possibility that we have more than five elements. That's what I wanted to ask. Is it a supramental substance?
No, I can't tell you anything about that. I think we should stick to what this very important point that Sri Aurobindo is sharing with us here, that there come in our human lives very, very, very difficult moments, ultimate challenges, when nothing we have learned, nothing we have built up, nothing can help us. But if in such a challenging moment we can come into contact with our unborn self, that can change everything. So that's the moment when everything can be turned around. These are moments we have to be very, very grateful for when they come. When it seems as if, Mother, I think she says it's when all seems lost, yeah, that everything can be changed, no? So that's the kind of moment that Savitri is facing now. She's come to on earth to save Satyavan from the grip of ignorance and death. And now here this moment has come, it's the day, and so far she hasn't been able to do that. He's still going to die today. So, what can she do? And this is somehow the topic of this canto. It's called The Issue. How is she going to deal with this situation? And this has some meaning for all of us. Any of us may be faced with a moment like that, a moment of choice, ultimate choice. And then, of course, the further lines explain how this comes about. So you had a third question? No, okay. Yes, Narayan.
This trail of old forgotten thoughts and deeds,
yeah,
is it the way the karma works?
Yes, it's referring to that old theory of karma.
That's the way it works, like old personalities and old thoughts and deeds. And
yes, that is, that's the basic theory of karma, no? Mm-hmm. That everything that is done in any kind of action, whether it's a thought or a deed or what it has a consequence, it has a universal consequence. And Mother says anything that we say and do just goes all around the universe and comes back to us. So, of course, the traditional theory of karma says that, if you fall ill or you lose all your money or you have an accident or something, this is a consequence of something that you've done in the past. That is not Sri Aurobindo's teaching. But he does say that there is this trail, we are carrying somehow something, the essence, we can say, of our whole past. And not only our own personal past, the whole universal past. No? Even the physicists, the biologists tell us this. No? We're carrying the whole history of the universe in our bodies, in our cells. So naturally that has an effect on what happens to us. So what part in us can free us from that chain, that fixed chain of determination that we are carrying with us and adding chains and links to the chain since the very beginning.
No? In the next line is disowned. The word disowned.
Yes.
It hangs on that.
Yes, it says that you say, no, there's a part of me that is not affected by this, that is free. And from there, finally at the end, that is what the Supreme Lord tells Savitri. He says, not from here you can make this choice. You have to go to that place in yourself and in existence, in omnipresent reality, that can make that choice, can free her from this chain.
From the beginning on, when I read by the mother, she don't understand why human beings don't, how you say, concentrate on the Supreme. They concentrate on all the things. No? Mm. I mean, on the Supreme, you always go to the higher, then it comes down.
Yes. There seems to be some reason.
Yeah.
What we were hearing about it the other day, that the Upanishad says, you know, that these individualized beings that we inhabit, we have the doors turned out. So it's not automatic. For Mother, obviously it was. She was born prepared, everything was prepared, that even at a very early age, she could feel and rely on that contact with the Supreme. For most of us, it's something that has to be built up. But such moments as these, if they come, we have to be very, very grateful for them.
Could you use another word, that word is disowned? I don't get fully the meaning.
Well, you say, it's not mine. Disown. I don't own it. It doesn't belong to me.
944?
Yes. So you've received a legacy from all the past and from the past of the universe, and you say, no, I don't want that. I want to be free of that.
Or some parents might decide they don't want to keep their property, they disown them.
They disown their children, yes. That's how it is sometimes used. Yes. You're not my child.
Yeah.
Yes. Fortunately, the Lord never disowns us. So the next lines continue on that theme. Naren.
An episode in an unremembered tale, its beginning lost, its motive and plot concealed. A once living story has prepared and made a present fate, child of past energies. The fixity of cosmic sequences, fastened with hidden even inevitable links, she must disrupt, dislodge by her soul's force. Her fast, a blot on the immortal's road, make a raised ground and shape anew her fate. A colloquy of the original gods, meeting upon the borders of the unknown, her soul's debate with embodied nothingness must be wrestled out on a dangerous dim background. Her being must confront its formless cause against the universe, weigh its single self. On the bare peak where self is alone with naught, and life has no sense and love no place to stand, she must plead her case upon extinction's verge. In the world's death age, upholds life's helpless claim and vindicate her right to be and love.
Thank you. So this first sentence is clear enough, no? It is that we're part of a long story, and what we are experiencing now, our present fate, is just an episode. They have these long television serials, no, telling the whole of the Mahabharata, and each hour is an episode. So our present fate is an episode, and we don't remember the story all that went before. Its beginning is lost, we've forgotten it. And so the meaning of this story and the plot of this story is hidden from us. But nevertheless, it's that story which has prepared and made our present fate, the situation we are in now. What we are experiencing now is born of past energies and forces that have been released into action. That's true for all of us. So for Savitri, what she has to do now, if she wants to change her present fate, is that she has to break this connection, this fixity of cosmic sequences. One thing follows another, all these determinations. She has to disrupt that. They are fastened together with these hidden, inevitable links. She must find a way to break that chain. And it's as if the weight of all her past is now blocking her future. It's a block. If she's going to live her immortal destiny, she has to remove that block from her road. She has to make everything clear and clean without anything inherited from the past. Make a fresh start. I see you saying, how, Don? But he's just described how. It's by coming in contact with that part which is eternally and infinitely free. We have that part. It is part of us. We are connected with it. If we can find that connection, then we can participate in its freedom. We don't have to be subject to our present fate, which is a construction made up of many different elements, partly all these influences from the past. So that's what she has to do.
This is a little outlandish. As far as I'm concerned, everything that I know about here on Earth and the universe, as far as I know about, comes from the big blast, I call it there.
The Big Bang.
The Big Bang. And so on there. From the Big Bang, everything that comes and happens,
yes, exactly.
We are there. She has to divorce herself from
all that. Bang. Yes. And the interesting thing is that we all have that possibility. There's a part of us who has come into this world that was created perhaps by the Big Bang or perhaps in some other way.
Yeah.
The self that we are aware of is formed by time and space and individualization. But what Sri Aurobindo is constantly reminding us is that this whole cosmos, material universe and all the subtle worlds, they're the product of a transcendent reality which isn't limited, but it inhabits all these forms, it pervades them, but it's not limited by them, any of them. And if we can contact within ourselves that free space, we can also, to a certain extent, be free. And the soul has willingly accepted all these limitations to do its work. It's accepted its karma and all that. But it also has this, we can say, its supreme destiny is to change that. And what we are doing now is going to, of course, influence our future. our future and the future of the human race, of the earth, of the universe. So that's why what we do now is important. So it says it's fixed, but that transcendent power, the spirit's timeless power, can unfix it. It is fixed.
Inevitable.
There's an expression that just said, everything matters, not it. Everything you do and don't do matters.
In the cosmos, everything has an effect, has a consequence. But if you can get out, then it doesn't.
So beings can transform this cause.
Yeah. So then this, according to me, this next sentence is the most interesting one for me, from my point of view, in the whole poem. He says, a colloquy of the original gods meeting upon the borders of the unknown, her soul's debate with embodied nothingness must be wrestled out on a dangerous, dim background. Her being must confront its formless cause, against the universe weigh its single self on the bare peak where self is alone with naught, and life has no sense and love no place to stand. She must plead her case upon extinction's verge, in the world's death cave, uphold life's helpless claim, and vindicate her right to be and love. This is the issue. This is not only the issue for Savitri, this is the issue of the whole poem for all of us. Yes, Audrey.
The original gods.
Yes. Who are they?
Yeah, and they are, this implies to me, this implies to me that they are invested in her not threatening their idea of what the universe is about.
He says a colloquy. A colloquy is a conversation between two people. And then he says a debate. He says this debate is between Savitri's soul and embodied nothingness.
Yeah.
This is the figure of death, negativity, of absolute negation which she has to meet.
They are debating this.
Savitri's soul and death are the original gods, the eternal yes and the eternal no.
So that's what this means about gods, the gods colloquy, that
they are representing the original question that's going on, no? Yes or no? Existence or non-existence.
So there's sort of an image of a court.
Yes, there's an image of a court, yes. She has to plead her case, and that's what we find her doing, no, in book 10 and book 11. She's pleading her case, insisting on it. And she has to do that, finally, on this bare peak above the universe, where the individual self is just facing non-existence, nothingness.
But she's also an original God.
Her soul is an original God, yes. And that's why she has the power to... And I think from what I've understood from Sri Aurobindo in the early chapters of The Life Divine, in fact, each of us is one of those, yes.
Yes.
Is one of those original gods, yes. And the one that is claiming our right to be and to love. No?
What does he mean by extinction's verge? Like
it means on the edge of extinction. She could cease to exist. There's a point where if the asat wins, then finish. The verge of extinction. We had a friend in Oroville here in the early days. He started a small community near Matrimandir. He called it Edge of Existence.
Yes.
You remember? Now it's just called Existence, yes. But he had his reasons for calling it that. Yes. Yes. I am existence. So, sort of hidden behind all this whole story, there's a very subtle message, I think, about the meaning of this creation, which we won't go into now. Yes, Mila.
This line, her being must confront its
formless cause.
This formless cause is supposed to be her transcendence, right?
I think it is this absolute. She has to face this absolute, which presents itself to her at one point as a formless reality which can cancel out her individual existence. She faces this all-negating absolute. It seems to be. It's as if for all of us, here we are, we've come into existence. What have we come out of? We've come out of something formless.
Affinity with the transcendent.
Yes.
But it seems here that because her
and the
is with death.
That death is representing himself as
death is,
he's saying, I am God, I am God, you are nothing, you are just a human individual. To us also, perhaps, death presents itself like that. Something absolute that can wipe out your existence. So here he's compressing it into very few words, but it's going to be developed in Book 10. I think we could say that there is a moment in Savitri's journey, in her process, where she has to confront this all-negating absolute, which says, you don't really exist. I just produce these illusions that you all are, that this whole world is. You have no right really to exist. You have definitely no right to ask for Satyavan to come back to life. You have no right to love. I'm the Lord of everything. And that is actually a very, very convincing power. She has to confront that. But she does, and she triumphs. Yes, that's what Mila's asking about. This seems to be the cause, the origin of everything.
But that is not death.
Huh? That is not death. No, definitely not death.
Death is, in the logical philosophy, there is no beginning without end. There is the end, so there's no existence in this sense, logically spoken.
Mm-hmm.
If you transcend it, there's an eternal existence. Mm-hmm. And your being partially ignorant, is following the philosophy, the logical philosophy.
Look, the next line says, against the universe, weigh its single self. There she is, she's a single human being like all of us. How can we confront this universe of which we are a product? How can we hope to change its rules? Its rules that say, Satyavan's dead, that's that, forget it. No? How can we hope to change something like that? He says we can. And here he's compressing it. That's why I say, in a way, I find it's two sentences, no? It's like there's a key here, if we can grasp this key, then we can understand many other things in the poem better. Right? Many other things in life better, perhaps.
Is death aware of it?
He's claiming to be the original God.
He's one of the gods.
I mean, here when he says gods, Sri Aurobindo is not meaning cosmic powers.
Mm-hmm.
No? So, yes. So, if we look at the very origin of things, a lot of spiritual experience, very true, valid spiritual experience, has led to the conclusion that the original cause of all this is something unknowable, and that unknowableness seems to ask us to dissolve back into it and lose our individuality. No? That this is the highest aim of spirituality, to dissolve, to merge back into that, whatever it is, that unknowable reality. That's been a very, very important thing, not only in Indian spirituality, but in other forms also. So, in this book, Sri Aurobindo shows first Asvapati having this experience. And he is then told that, yes, you have met the eternal no. And it's very, very liberating. It frees you from your past and everything. But then he's told, but it's not the end. There's something else to find. There's also the eternal yes. And he meets the eternal yes in the form of the Supreme Divine Mother.
Motive of the plot. Motive of the plot.
The motive and the plot, yes. In the plot of this cosmic story, reaching the absolute, the eternal no, is not the end. There's something more. Yes, right. A last twist. And in Savitri's story, she has this experience in a different way. It's in this canto, Nirvana and the all-negating absolute. She has the experience of being on the verge of extinction. No? That there seems to be no reason why her individual existence should continue at all. But she's already extinguished herself so much that she hasn't got an individual will. It's not up to her to decide whether she continues to exist or not. She just has to wait and see what is the will of that supreme reality. And she's eventually shown the eternal yes, and that she is part of it, and her role in that that part of the cosmic play. So I think that is kind of summed up in these two enigmatic sentences. Yes, Andras?
So the Runo makes reference to the experience of Nirvana?
I beg your pardon?
So the eternal law makes reference to the experience of Nirvana?
I would say these are parallel ways for us to express in our human language this experience, which Sri Aurobindo has called the Nirvana experience, and then somewhere else he's referred to it as the silent Brahman. And in this poem, he refers to it as the all-negating absolute. Yes, Naran.
I think in these lines, he's also trying to tell us the battleground where the gods fight, on the verge of extinction, all that, where these two ultimate people will meet. Mm-hmm. He's also telling the battleground, describing the battleground where she's going to meet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's a bit confusing between original god and verge of extinction and colloquial of gods. That's why she's just describing it's above humanity, above a normal plane, and there they'll have their fight. Maybe that's my take on this.
Yes, if we think, as I said last week, that what we are reading now is a kind of overture to the whole poem, where he's referring briefly to things that are going to be explored much more in detail further on. So here we can say that what he's referring to here, what Savitri is going to have to face, after Satyavan dies, she has to face the force of cosmic consequence and of nothingness, embodied nothingness, these different forces. And it's very, very surprising the way it develops. He's just briefly giving us a little hint of that theme, which gets developed much more thoroughly in Cantos, in Book 10 and Book 11, first part of Book 11. Yes.
And I hear, maybe I don't hear correctly, but I think I hear those are our deep inner souls.
You can say they may be the original principles that are at work in our in this manifestation.
Yeah.
Yes. Not only in us, but in the creation as a whole. I have tried to write an article about this. It's in one of the issues of Invocation. It's a series of two articles. It's called The Characters of Savitri, I think. And the second one, it is about this confrontation between death and Savitri. When I realized this colloquy of the original gods who are meeting on the borders of the unknown, this colloquy of the original gods is the debate of Savitri's soul with embodied nothingness, with this nothingness which puts on for her this form of the god of death. But he changes also in the course. He changes his form, and eventually he appears to her as the Supreme Lord. In one way or another,
yeah.
Yes.
That's
why that.
Death can
evolve,
and we can evolve, right?
Yes.
Even death can
evolve. The Lord presents himself to us in different aspects to help us to evolve. And I think what you say, Audrey, that we are all going to be confronted by this sooner or later, that's why Sri Aurobindo has given us this guidebook. Shall we go on? Yes, sir.
Mother, when she starts to explain Savitri, when mother starts to explain Savitri in her first four or five lines, she tells a story that originally there was light, there was love, life, etc.
Yes.
So those four were the original gods. When they start falling down to the lower level, they lost connectivity and they became their opposites.
Yes, yes.
So when
they
talk that, you know, they it's only that is why she talks of transformation to the original nature.
Yes.
Evolution, you may call it a transformation. So it's not that you uproot that and then you'll gain something, so you have to go back. So she could be referring to those original gods and the other gods, those four original, the light. The
you remember what they were? There's light, consciousness,
truth,
life, and bliss.
Yeah, bliss, yeah.
Mm? So each of them turns into their opposites. Yes.
They were actually to make the world, but they turned into their opposites.
Yes.
That is why we talk about transformation.
Why we have to go back to the original state. Yes. I think you're right, sir. Thank you. Shall we read on?
Yes.
Yes, this dangerous dim background. Hmm.
Yeah, because it's disappearing.
No, it's night. He's fighting with the night. And that's again the battleground he's just describing. Where she fights with death.
Background, past, or the body, or something.
It's like a picture, isn't it? There's Savitri, and there's the god of death, and they are having their debate. They are confronting each other with words, with truths, and somehow the background to all that is dangerous and dim because it's not clear who is going to prevail.
And that is telling hard truths.
That man, he changed from the entry. So that is his, the background of the scene
is the worlds that he has made.
But he changed the background because according to what is convinced from him, he adopts the background to his purpose.
That's right.
And that's the nature.
Yes.
That she will be distracted by that, that he has convinced falsely. She's not wrong.
It seems as if these worlds through which she passes after the death, when she's following Satyavan's soul, they are somehow projected by death. There's the world of eternal night, and then there's the world of the double twilight, the twilight of the ideal, the twilight of the earthly real, and then there's the everlasting day. But even there, she has to go on insisting.
And then the nice thing is that at the end he says, don't ask me, ask him.
No, he doesn't.
He admits that he is not there.
No, he doesn't even say that. He says, you have the power to decide, but you can't do it here. You will have to go up to this world, transcendent world. And from there, you have to see everything, and then you decide.
And it's dim because that tells half truth. I remember, it's very confusing. He tells truth, but mixes with falsehood. So it's very confusing and dim and dull. The arguments.
Shall we read on a little bit? Yes, that's. Yes. Who is next? Manohar.
Altered must be nature's harsh economy. Acquaintance she must win from her past bond, and all the count of suffering exhausted. Strike out from time the soul's long compound debt, and the heavy servitude of the karmic gods, the slow revenge of unforgiving law, and the deep need of universal pain, and hard sacrifice and tragic consequence. Out of a timeless barrier she must break, penetrate with her thinking depths the void's monstrous hush, look into the lonely eyes of immortal death, and with her nude spirit measure the infinite now. The great and dolorous moment now was close. A male battalion marching to its doom. The last long days went by with heavy tramp, long but too soon to pass, too near the end.
Thank you. In order for Savitri to be able to vindicate, to justify her right to be and love, the whole balance of forces of nature has to be changed, altered, must be nature's harsh economy. She has to get free of this bondage of the past. The debt has to be paid. There's this old account of suffering. It has to be paid off. The soul's long compound debt has to be struck out from time. A compound debt is a debt that goes on getting bigger and bigger and bigger because you have to pay interest on the interest. Compound debt, yes. It keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So somehow she has to do something very big, finally, to alter that whole economy and strike out the debt. And of course, if you can't pay your debt, you may be turned into a kind of bonded laborer. So that's the heavy servitudes of the karmic gods. You would have to go on serving them and suffering the slow revenge of unforgiving law, the karmic law, which involves this deep need of universal pain and hard sacrifice and tragic consequence. So in order to do that, she has to break out of this timeless barrier, this barrier that's been there forever, no? With her thinking depths, her consciousness, she has to penetrate this monstrous silence, this unbelievably huge and powerful silence and emptiness, and look into the lonely eyes of immortal death. There's just the two of them. They have to confront each other, and there will be this debate, this colloquy. So with her nude spirit, without any of the protections of nature, of human nature, of earth nature, she has to measure the strength of the infinite. Herself, confronting with her small individual self, she has to confront that infinity. That's what she has to do.
I think this says that the world's economic problems are all that also have a spiritual solution.
Sure.
Many people feel oppressed, you know, if they're in poverty or debt.
Yes.
Such a psychological burden it is.
When you tell about this, this Desna and Savitri, I remember in the interview I played more than a year ago with Asta Patel, that in the work with the mother, she was 14 or something like this, and the mother gave her and another one Savitri's text, confronting Savitri and death, and so asked her to play death, and Asta said no, 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 and then the mother said, the death has not to be feared, it has to be conquered.
Yes.
So it's something the same.
It really gives a lot of thought to the way in which death is so entwined from the beginning in life. And it is not an easy prospect here, because if one even thinks of the primary causes of actual death when somebody finally shuffles off, it's cardiovascular disease, which has to do with the vessels and the cells and the blood flow. It's, you know, things to do with diabetes or sugar control and how the body responds to those things. And it's the lungs, how the air passes through those passages. And these are things that are ongoing for all of us all the time that we are alive. We think we have life, but right next to it we're holding death.
Yes, he's with us. I think there's a line about that, you know, that he's a dim bystander at our birth, and he's our companion all the way through. You know. But then it says, but other is the riddle of his face. I see if I can find that. Yes, where can I find that? Although death walks beside us on life's road, a dim bystander at the body's start, and a last judgment on man's futile works, other is the riddle of its ambiguous face. Death is a stair, a door, a stumbling stride the soul must take to cross from birth to birth, a gray defeat pregnant with victory, a whip to lash us towards our deathless state. That is the bottom of page 600.
I have thought that this canto is antidote to anybody's trouble, whatever it is.
Which canto?
This canto, the issue. Whatever your issue is, if you read this canto,
yes,
when you get to the end of it, you feel reborn.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So we'll go on with it next time.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you want to read a little further now?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, all right, Patty, go ahead.
Alone amid the many faces loved, aware among unknowing happy hearts, her armored spirit kept watch upon the hours, listening for a foreseeing tremendous step in the closed beauty of the inhuman wilds, a combatant in silent, dreadful bliss, the world unknowing, for the world she stood. No helper had she, save the strength within. There was no witness of terrestrial eyes. The gods above and nature's soul below were the spectators of that mighty strife. Around her were the austere sky-pointing hills and the green, murmurous, broad, deep-thoughted woods muttered incessantly their muffled spell. A dense, magnificent-colored, self-wrapped light draped in the leaves of vivid emerald monotone and set with checkered sunbeams and blithe flowers immured her destiny's secluded scene.
Thank you. He gives the image of a single combat. In ancient times, if two armies confronted each other and their commander saw that actually they were more or less equal, wasn't clear what the outcome of a big battle would be, rather than having an enormous slaughter, they would agree that each side should choose their champion, and there would be a single combat between the two champions, and whoever won the battle for his side. So this is the image here. Savitri is a combatant in silent, dreadful lists. The lists is a place that's marked out for a single combat. She's representing the world. The world knows nothing about it. Usually there will be the armies gathered around cheering on their champion. No. But The world doesn't know that she's standing for them. So she has no helper except her own inner strength. And there's no human being watching. No human being is aware of this combat. The gods above and nature, soul below, were the spectators of that mighty strife. It suggests that the earth nature or the spirit of earth nature is conscious that this conflict is going on.
What if it is also ephemeral or it says deep thoughted words.
Mm. Yes.
So it's an illusion.
What?
Her world as a human being now is an illusion. Her soul is in combat with death.
Yes. Mm. But it's not an illusion. He's giving a very beautiful description of this scenery, this forest where she's living, and the atmosphere there. And he's even going to tell us that environment has helped her to prepare herself for this moment. No?
Well, then why does he say?
No, he several times in the poem he suggests this. The forest represents life. And he says it's as if it's in a kind of enchanted trance of deep concentration, withdrawn. I think that's why he uses this word, deep-thoughted. It's not the kind of thoughts that we have and we discuss and we bandy them round, but the whole atmosphere of that forest is of a deep inner concentration.
Would you say that concentration is there because she's there with these thoughts? She knows this is the day.
No, he's describing the forest, the environment, and
the physical world.
Yes. And we next time we will read the next lines. I think that the, or perhaps we read them now. You will read, Sudha. Would you read the next line?
Immured.
It means walled in, surrounded. Would you read the next line, Sudha? 101. Thank you. Now it makes sense. Yeah. It's beautiful, huh?
Yeah, if there would have been a gap between these two, around, it would have been very clear that he's coming back to the physical world instead of the fight.
What we have gained by yoga is not isolated. It is the whole being of that.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
The environment.
Yes.
What if you don't believe in God or gods, and that has no relevance? So if we use this poem to be more universal, if one looks at it as being much more universal, what are those concepts? What is being spoken of?
Well, even if you don't believe in God, you know what that word means to people who do believe in. And so I think there's a concept here that had left deep room for her and a contact with the divine, maybe even a personal contact.
And earlier on when it says the gods above,
gods, usually gods, these are the cosmic powers, the universal powers forces, yes.
But throughout history, people have gone to the forest or the garden
to find deep room for thought and God. Yes. Well, it's a retreat from the human world and a search for something deeper and more meaningful and significant, you know, finding yourself, actually. Yeah.
Human. Mm-hmm. We're talking about physical human. Well, but also emotional.
That's a combination. In the human history, this fight, like two combatants fighting and avoiding battle, how common was it?
I think it was exceptional, but anyway, it happened. Yeah. And you can think that it's a very good idea, actually. Yeah. We should put Trump and Kim in a wrestling ring and see if they can decide the fate of the earth. Oh dear, shouldn't have said that. So let's listen to what Mother says.
Om Nam Savitri. Here, with the suddenness divine events have, repeating the marvel of the first to descend, changing to rapture the dull earthly realm, love came to her, hiding the shadow dead. Where might he find in her his perfect sight? An absolute supernatural darkness falls on man sometimes when he draws near to God. An hour comes when fail all nature's needs, forced out from the protecting ignorance and flung back on his naked primal knees. He at length must cast from him his surface soul and be the ungarbed entity within. That hour has fallen now on Savitri. Around her, where the austere sky pointing is, and the green murmurous, broad, deep, shouted words muttered incessantly, their muffled spell. A dead, magnificent, colored, self-right light, draped in the leaves, vivid emerald monotone, and set wind-shuckled sunbeams and blithe flowers immured her destiny's secluded scenes. There had she gone to the statue of her hills, and the mighty whiteness of the primitive earth and the brooding multitude of patient trees and the musing sapphire letters of the sky and the solemn weight of the slowly passing months had left in her deep room for soul and thought. There was her drama's radiant prologue.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.